The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
This morning I want to begin with just a brief postscript at the tail end of what I closed with yesterday. I gave as the eighth practical suggestion, be patient, persistent, mindful that you must persuade the elders, the lay leaders of your church, of the importance of evangelism, or you may run into some problems yourself in your evangelistic outreach, and you will, if you do not exercise patience and instruction of your leaders, you will be running ahead of them, and you won't be teaching them in the way that you want to do. Now, I just want to add this postscript. It takes time for the average congregation to develop enough concern for the unsaved and unchurched. Assuming now you are serving a congregation that has not been strongly oriented in that direction from the beginning. Now, you may be fortunate enough to be in a situation where you've got lay leadership that's even way ahead of you in your commitment to evangelism. But in the course of your ministry, maybe some of you already are there, you will probably serve a church in some place where the leadership has not focused on evangelism for some decades, maybe never. And you will find it to be an uphill fight, at least at first, to gradually turn the thinking of that congregation around and direct them more toward the community. And in some of our denominations, we have almost a long history of being insular in our church life. And it is to that particular problem that I want to address a few remarks before we get on with the whole matter of evangelistic preaching. And there's one facet of this problem that I just want to share a few ideas with you about, and that is the willingness to be neglected. Because I have found in my pastoral ministry that that is where the rub comes in the cases of many people. The willingness to be neglected for the sake of the unchurched and the unsaved. Now, it takes time for congregations to develop that willingness to be, and now I use the word neglected a bit facetiously, because I don't think in most cases they're neglected at all. They're actually being better pastored than they would be if you gave them 110% of all your devotion and time. But the moment you begin to shift even 5 or 10% of your time and energy toward the community, toward those who aren't paying your salary, mind you, there will be those who will express, or at least behind your back, will express to one another a degree of dissatisfaction that pastor is spending an awful lot of time with those folks down the street. Okay? Robert Schuller, and I'm no devotee of Robert Schuller, believe me. I could write a book on what I don't like about him. I consider him my brother, but his methods as a pastor I don't care for in many ways. However, he does have many interesting things that we can borrow. And one time I heard him tell an account, and maybe this has appeared in some of his books, perhaps you know about it, but he gives the account of that first disastrous pastorate he had in the Midwest, in which he was pastoring a very traditional church that was not at all community-oriented. And he was chafing under that limitation. And one day, he got two phone calls back-to-back while he was putting his hat and coat on to answer the one call the phone rang again, and there was another call. And there were two men who had had heart attacks and were dying. They had been rushed to two separate hospitals. And out in the Midwest where he was pastoring, those hospitals were rather far apart. And you couldn't pick up both in one trip. The one man was a leading elder of his church, one of the pillar figures, the kind you rush to when he needs your help in something. And he's had a massive heart attack. He's being taken to the hospital. His wife is called, and you are dashing to the door when the phone rings again. And Schuller tells that in the second call, it's this pagan down the street that he had been working with for a long time and got to nowhere with the fellow. The guy hated religion, pastors, and all the like, and he's had a heart attack. And he gasps to his wife as they put him in the ambulance, "Call the reverend and get him down here. I need to talk to him." Talk about a Heinz dilemma. You've got one there. Hospital A is where your dying elder is. Hospital B in the opposite direction is where this gross old pagan friend that you've been frustrated with has called for you, and he may die before sundown. Now, where do you go? Well, Schuller went to the bedside of the lost. And the man received Christ and died, and Schuller did his funeral and went on to minister to the family. The elder recovered and was furious. His whole family was furious. And as soon as he was out of the hospital and on his feet again, the family left the church. And of course, that type is always related to half your congregation, so you got all the rest of them mad at you too. All right, now think for a minute. Supposing you had been the elder, not the elder who had the heart attack, but some other leader in that church, how would you have felt about your pastor's decision? And if you had been the pastor, what would you have done? Oh, it's easy for us sitting in the classroom to decide that. But out there in that pastorate, those pressures to take care of the sheep, brother, are tremendous. Okay, what is your response? You're suggesting that he might have been able to create a third option to sort of soften the blow in the elder's family. Yeah. He doesn't give other details. That this is the way he presented the dilemma. Maybe that could have been done. All right, that would have been another option, and a very good one. Call another elder. Get a prayer chain informed and things happening. Okay? Well, you think about it. Dave, what would you have done? Yeah, theoretically you're right. And in some cases that works. But I think in most instances it's the pastor they want. You may not have an elder, this is say 11 o'clock in the morning, free to go and respond to a call like that. Circumstances differ. But you're right. Another person ought to be able to minister in either of those instances as well. Whether it does is the question. Well, what do the rest of you think? Does that text do good to all men, but especially to the household of faith, apply here? I can see where it could be used to defend a choice here. I think your hand was first. You're saying that the didactic value of the choice of the latter person, the lost man, the didactic value is a service to the household of faith. Okay, that's an interesting thought. If leave he wants to do, then let him do that. It might be for his good and the church's. Another suggestion. Well, that's an interesting. You're suggesting that. I hear the tail end of your comment suggesting there might have been something weak about that elder's faith if he reacted the way he did to the fact that the pastor went to an unsaved person first. Very obviously, the evangelistic dimension of the elder's role had not gotten through to him very well if he reacted that way. It's interesting.
Dr. Greenway, I think we have to remember that Jesus' words, that when he said that he did not come to call the righteous to repentance, and that he also came to save and to seek the lost. I think that what he did in going to seek the lost, one soul had been won to the kingdom. And as far as his responsibility to seek the lost was good. It was right. It was a good work. However, you know, what he should have done was taken some of his other leadership, his other elders, and sent him to his other elders. You know, so that way he's covering both. And it doesn't really matter who's going, as long as both. But really, just the responsibility to the lost is still present with us today.
Okay, good. Hand back here. Yeah.
So that they might know ahead of time what your approach or philosophy or priority is to minister, and that they might use those same principles as elders in their ministry.
I think that the Heinz dilemma that Schuller gives us is a good little tool that you might use with your elders sometime, as you use an elders meeting to discuss your philosophy of ministry and your own sense of calling to evangelism, as well as the care and nurture of the lambs in the flock. Now, this is the kind of thing that you may want to discuss with a session before accepting a call, for example. You may find that there are churches that are looking for pastors who have exactly that philosophy of ministry, as well as churches who are totally against it. You might decide that you want to go to such a church that's negative on the whole idea of evangelism, just as your sense of mission to change that church, but that's a decision you want to make. But I think you're right. It's a good idea to, long before such a crisis occurs, to be preparing your elders that particular kind of dilemma doesn't happen very often, and yet in little ways that kind of thing does crop up. The first time that you really need that Saturday night to get your sermon ready to the next morning, and you're called to spend the entire evening or perhaps even a night working with an unsaved family, that's going to be your moment of truth as to where your priorities lie and what kind of balance you intend to maintain. And I think that discussing these things with your lay leadership and your elders is extremely important. It's part of your teaching ministry in that church to make the church what it ought to be. Now, you never get 100% of them in support of that outreach and outlook. There will always be some who feel you're cheating them. And I guess what you've got to convince them of, that if they for legitimate or illegitimate reasons feel neglected at some point, it's not because you're lazy. It's not neglect due to sloth, but an intentional neglect of the 99 who are in the fold in order that the one who's out there in the bushes will be brought home. And again, I say you aren't going to get them all in behind you. Every congregation, consciously or unconsciously, tends to monopolize every ounce of a pastor's time and energy. There is always one more call you should make, one more counseling session to give, one more person who wants to get your advice or your opinion or your help, one more trip to make. There is no end to it. The last church I pastored in Michigan, I conducted 55 funerals in a month short of 4 years. Now, a funeral isn't just a funeral. A funeral represents usually a lot of calls to the hospital, ministry to widows and widowers, children, in connection with the death. And when you've got that kind of a schedule in a large church, and you're trying to do evangelism at the same time, brother, you put your head on the pillow every night with a certain sense of guilt and incompleteness and inadequacy and all the like. that you just have to ask the Lord to erase from your mind so you'll never sleep. Believe me, you aren't going to convince them all. I had a couple in that church. Boy, they could never stomach an ounce of energy on the pastor's part for anyone who wasn't a paying member of the club. I remember one afternoon, I'd had a particularly fruitful day as far as unchurched people in the community inching their way towards the church, towards me as a pastor. Things had been very fruitful, and I was just ready to leave the office late in the afternoon. The secretary was packing up, and a phone call came in. And here was one of these neighborhood unchurched families calling me to the hospital. Father had had a heart attack and was very close to death. Would I quickly come? Well, of course, I did. I grabbed my coat and was heading for the door. I told the secretary I was leaving for such and such a hospital. And there was standing, as they always are, by the office door, one of these dear members. And as I went through the door, she said, with a barb so big you could hardly get through the door, well, it seems like today you're spending all your time with the people who aren't members of this church. And of course, what she meant was people who aren't paying your salary. Now, that wasn't an average day. It was one of those rather unique days. And I was excited about some of the things that had happened. But I tell you, all the way to the hospital, I was just calming my blood pressure. She'd blown it for me. My peace and harmony were all disturbed as I had to get down to a little repenting and reaffirm in my own mind that I was maintaining a biblical balance in my total ministry. Though perhaps that day it wasn't balanced as it usually was, but that day was a day the Lord was sending me to the hedges. But you aren't going to win them all. And there'll always be those critics out there in the congregation who, no matter what you do for them, always feel you're off balance. And then what you've got to do is you've got to reaffirm in your own mind that you're doing what Paul did in Ephesians. We studied that yesterday in Acts 20. You've got to be reminded that if you don't do it, they won't do it either. Believe me, if the pastor isn't calling on the unsaved, the elders seldom do either. You'll have some exceptions, but they'll follow your lead. You are the leader. They will do, in the long run, what they've seen you do, not just what they've heard you say that they ought to do. And it's also true that within the church, the members can be more effectively ministered to very often by elders and fellow members. The mutual ministry of the saints to one another is generally more acceptable and more effective, whereas the ability to cross over into the community sometimes is done very effectively by laymen, but not always. And in the community, very often, that unsaved person, in the moment of crisis, is looking for a pastor. They want to see the minister from down the street. And then don't worry too much about the lady standing at the office door, your office or wherever you may be, because generally the ones that complain are over-pampered sheep anyway. And there's no way of satisfying them. You could dedicate all your time to them and they would still have one complaint more to meet. Was there a hand? Well, I think that the larger a church grows and the more diversified its activities and its ministries, the more you're going to have staff and specializations. And you recall that we talked about the two texts, the 2 Timothy 4:5 and then the Ephesians 4:11 text, where Ephesians definitely suggests that there are those who are specially gifted to be evangelists. This is their particular role. just as though there are those who are pastors who function also evangelistically, there are evangelists who, in the course of their work, will function pastorally. You can't separate the two rigidly. And I think that the having on your staff a minister of evangelism, if he is so gifted, is a wonderful thing. I know of churches that have that. Now, quite often, what you get is a kind of a bureaucrat who sits in an office somewhere designing all kinds of schemes for other people to do the job, and no visible indication that he's particularly gifted in that area. But that was the job description they were advertising, and he applied and got the position. Now, you'd be very careful about that. But I'm thinking of one church that has hired an evangelist who is definitely gifted in that area. And he and the pastor work in a beautiful relationship, and that church is growing, as all kinds of people are being drawn to that church. And that minister of evangelism also functions educationally within the congregation, heightening their consciousness level of their evangelistic obligations. It's a beautiful relationship. So often the church doesn't have a place for those kind of gifted Christians, and they go off and join a parachurch organization where they are free to exercise their gifts. The parachurch organizations in America are replete with evangelism-gifted Christians who couldn't find a place to use their commitment and their gifts within the established churches. Yeah. Just as the evangelist will also function pastorally to those that are coming in. You know, it's impossible to separate these two rigidly. Just to use the metaphor of our Lord's parable, the shepherd who's gone out and he's found this bedraggled lamb that's all torn and tattered down there in the ravine, the moment he's found him, he lifts him up, he puts him on his shoulder, and he's acting like a pastor bringing the lamb home. Huh? And so the pastor is involved evangelistically, the evangelist is involved pastorally, and there's no rigid distinction between the two. Which I think is the very impact that Paul was trying to get across to Timothy. Fulfill your ministry, brother. That was exactly what I was going through on my way to the hospital after that barbed remark by the lady at the door. And this is going to happen over and over again. It can happen every week. And you've got to have your own philosophy of ministry intact to withstand those storms. And that's what you're saying, and that's very, very true. And it can come very subtly and very unexpectedly. An attack on whether you are fulfilling your ministry, which is exactly what Paul is saying. Fulfill your ministry. Well, you better know what that ministry is, or you'll never know what you're fulfilling. And if you don't know, they'll find out. Okay, now let's launch into the main topic of today, evangelistic preaching, or the kind of preaching that goes on in the average worship service, and how do you build into it the evangelistic dimension. Let me begin by a little true story. A few years ago, I was talking with one of those pillar elders of a large Reformed church in the Midwest, and he was describing the struggle they had gone through with an unchristian, unchurched neighbor, and the man's wife, with whom they had worked for years, lived next door to each other, witnessed to them, urged them to go to church, and they'd always refused. And then some crises had come into the neighbor's life. Ill health was beginning to frighten them. And one day they gave in and said, "All right, we'll try it once. We'll go to church with you next Sunday." So this elder and his wife were very excited. They had one shot at this neighbor. They were going to bring him to church. And you know what he told me? He said, "We took them to Calvary Baptist Church." Now, some of you are Baptists, and you say, "Praise the Lord, he made a great." That was a wise Presbyterian. He took him to a Baptist church. And I said to him, "Well, why in the world didn't you take him to your own church where you're an elder?" Well, he sort of hung his head sheepishly and said, "Well, you know, what the situation is at our church. We've got a wonderful minister, and he's a great preacher, but we knew we had just one chance with this couple. And we figured that if we took them down to the Baptist church, they'd hear the gospel loud and clear. And at our church, they might not understand what was being said. Well, you say, well, that's an exaggerated instance. It's a true one. Absolutely. Maybe it's exaggerated, but I'm afraid that it isn't as exaggerated as we wish it were. Now, let's be thinking of our own services, maybe last Sunday's or the week before. And imagine that you were an outsider coming to your church. Now, outsider. I mean a guy who thinks John 3:16 is a men's room on the third floor. Haven't you ever thought of that before? You all thought it was a text in the Bible, but I didn't know that. First time I've been to church. I don't know this religious jargon. And here I hear about Elijah says, Elijah? That's a guy down the street. He's a boxer. Moses? Paul and Romans? Paul and Romans? These people are out of their tree? They all stand up and recite the Apostles' Creed, and I never heard of this thing. Everybody knows what to do except me. And then you have these wonderful liturgical services where nothing is announced and everybody knows what to do. And I've never had a songbook in my life, and on top of that, I can't sing. And so I don't come back. Now think of your church. Just think. And imagine yourself creeping in the back door and sitting there in a pew and listening to yourself and everything that goes on. And would you come back? And then take your sermons apart. 99% of the sermons preached in our churches assume a religious heritage, a lot of knowledge, and a great deal of stamina on the part of the hearers. All right, now I want to give the next bit of time a series of comments, insights. They're kind of strung together like beads on a string, not necessarily in any particular order. But they're things that have come out of my reading and ministry, and I'm pretty convinced about them. The first has to do with good biblical preaching, which I think is the thing that builds churches and grows Christians. Now, when I say good biblical preaching, I'm not necessarily talking about what you and I do all the time. But I mean the kind of excellence in presenting the gospel that a Spurgeon achieved, and at least we can strive toward. That which is eminently doctrinal, biblical, powerful, and so down to earth that Tom Jones and Mary Smith coming from the street can understand what the guy up there is saying. And the Spirit doesn't have to overcome unnecessary barriers that we've put up to use that message to change lives. We believe in a sovereign, omnipotent God, but let's not put him to the test by our sermons. At least not intentionally. Okay, now I'm going to take a rather long, what may appear to be an enormous digression, but you'll find out what I have in mind. I want to give you something that Lyle Shaler has written. Now, Shaler is, you probably all know the name. He's a rather famous church consultant. He writes books prolifically. He's director of the Yoke Fellow Institute over in Indiana. And he's probably the leading analyst in America today of churches, those that grow and those that don't. And he is usually very helpful. He has a number of books out. I recommend his books to you. Now, he has an article which appeared a year or two ago, and I'm trying to look for the reference here. If I don't have it, I will have to apologize. It appeared in a magazine called The Second Monday, 1981. I don't seem to find my reference here, but what he calls them are the seven earmarks of a growing church. And I want to give them now because the very first one is biblical preaching. And I'll give you the other earmarks also, and then I'm going to make some comments as to how they're related and maybe defend my digression at this point. He talks about the seven earmarks of a growing church, and he says the very first one is excellent biblical preaching. He says people are hungry for it. And Schiller is not putting that there because he knows that's what we want to see, want to hear, and our theology places preaching in number one position. But he's putting it there because of his own study of what draws people to churches and what makes churches grow and congregations succeed. He said, by and large, the number one thing is the excellence of the preaching. Number two, he says there's an atmosphere of evangelism in those churches. Growing churches have a cadre of indigenous lay evangelists. It's not all left to the pastor or to a few mission enthusiasts. Evangelism in these churches is a shared concern. Third, he says these churches have a strong emphasis on koinonia, fellowship. I thought it's rather interesting what he says there. He says every church has two circles. You have the membership circle, and then most churches have the fellowship circle. And in most churches, traditional churches, the non-growing churches, the membership circle is larger than the fellowship circle because we all have a number of non-active people who remain all their lives sort of marginal. They come to church, but they never join anything, they never get active, they never participate. And he says, now, the difference between these two circles is a membership is the people in the church directory, perhaps, the people that are officially full members of your church. But the fellowship circle consists of those who interact. They know one another. They're doing something. They participate in the shared activities, and they feel, this is very important, they feel a part of that congregation. In most traditional congregations, the fellowship circle is much smaller than the membership because many do not get involved. Now, he says, in the growing churches, it's just the opposite. The membership circle is smaller than the fellowship circle. Because, you see, these churches have people coming in who are tasting the koinonia that the church uniquely provides, and they may be coming in real fast and within a short time join the membership. They may for many years stay in this wider circle. But the characteristic of the growing church is it has a broad fellowship profile, which is drawing people from the outside. Now, how does that happen? Well, he talks about, for example, various programs and activities, classes, study groups that draw in people. The Sunday school, for example, will have many, many people who are not members, but they are part of the fellowship circle. You may have classes of various kinds offered at the church. You may have a sport program. I have found sport activities to be very effective if you're not restricting membership on the ball team to being a full member. But let that fellowship circle include a lot of people who may still be Roman Catholic, who knows what, but already they're beginning to feel to be part of this group. They're coming into the fellowship. They're getting influenced by the teaching, by the love, and all the rest. You might even look at your church directory sometimes. Shayla doesn't mention that, but I've noticed that sometimes church secretaries get very stubborn on this. They want to limit the church directory just to those who are, you know, card-carrying Presbyterians. But watch out for that. There's room, there's need for that one directory that's of the fellowship circle. All those who somehow feel related to that church. Who would they call if an emergency, a crisis came into their lives? Would they call you even though they're not professing members? Who do they go to with a problem? When Mary needs counseling, who do they go to? These are all indicators of whether they're in that fellowship family. Schiller says, the growing churches are those that work on their fellowship circle. And it's larger than the membership circle, considerably larger. I think he's right. And of course, you develop that fellowship circle through community-oriented programs, through shaking the ladies' aid loose so that Mary Jaworski from down the street begins to attend, and so forth. Four, Shaler mentions, and I think this is rather interesting. He says, growing churches offer opportunities to express commitment. Opportunities to express commitment. And I think this is a rather interesting approach to the biblical teaching of gifts. Because so often I hear pastors talking about the fact that there are many gifts in their church that aren't being utilized. Oh, if only my members would use their gifts. Well, I have used that language too. I think after reading Schiller, I'm going to be more cautious. Because there's a kind of exploitation implied whenever we talk about using people's gifts and utilizing the talents of our congregation. Hey, the service stance of a church ought to be developing programs, channels, doors, so that members may express freely their commitment, which is expressed, of course, through the utilization of their gifts. But they do the utilization. They do the using, not us. Our concern is that we provide the kind of church where members' gifts, in terms of their commitment to God, may be freely channeled, expressed, made visible. And I think that's a good approach to the whole question of gifts and how they come to expression in the church's life. Schiller says, those churches that provide lots of opportunities for members to express their commitment, even non-members, some of the fellowship family that's coming into the membership circle. Already they can start expressing that level of commitment at which they've already arrived. They can do it within the fellowship of the church. Number five, Shaler talks about imported leadership. Now, he doesn't mean that you send abroad and bring in some folks from other countries. And he's talking about something that I know this is very, very relevant to many of our congregations. Who runs the church? The fine families that have been there for 100 years, or can the newcomer break through the barriers and get to be a deacon and elder? If he's so gifted, and qualified? Or are the leadership positions restricted to those old stock members who have always run this church? And I think we all know what that's like. In some communities, the church is always run by certain groups, certain families. Number six, he talks about specialties in ministry, specializations. Growing churches, says Shaler, in addition to the traditional ministries that almost every church has, the growing churches have seized on one or more specialties, something they do very well, and everybody knows they're doing it. And he said the characteristics of these specialties are they're person-centered, they have a strong evangelistic dimension built right into them, and they offer those who participate opportunities to express themselves. Okay, now why this rather long digression? Oh yeah, one more he mentions, number seven. I mustn't forget this one. He says also, growing churches have ministers who like people. Ministers who like people. Hey, you know, that sounds funny, but not all ministers do. Ministers may like books. They may dream of becoming seminary professors. Horrors. But do they really like people? With all their warts and wrinkles and idiosyncrasies. You know, one time in Mexico, I was called in by the pastor of a certain Presbyterian church that they've been having lots of trouble with their Sunday school teachers. Their whole Sunday school program wasn't going very well. That had some teachers quit. So they asked if, you know, the role of a foreigner very often is he's neutral and hopefully objective enough that he can kind of come in and do a thing that the local folk would have a hard time doing and saying. So I was called in to sort of assess what was wrong in this. I had a large Sunday school, a good-sized Presbyterian church in Mexico City. And they had a university professor who was the superintendent of the Sunday school, very, very learned fellow. And he had, in the course of the previous few years, renovated the whole Sunday school. He'd changed a lot of things, and he'd done some good things. He was very, very bright in educationally. He knew how to select materials and organize a good program, but nothing went well. I spent a lot of time. I felt that the problem probably was in him. So I spent a lot of time talking with him, sipping coffee together. And I'll never forget the day when the light shone through what was really the problem there. He said to me, "You know, my problem is I love to run this Sunday school. It fascinates me, selecting these materials, organizing this all, but," he said, "I hate kids." Huh? And I'm afraid sometimes men get into the pastoral ministry who don't have a great deal of love for people. Okay, why this long digression? Very quickly. I think Shaler has a lot of good ideas here, but you notice once again, he puts quality biblical preaching number one. You see, the preaching is what sets the tone for everything else in the church. If we really take Romans 10, verse 17, literally, then not only does that initial faith unto salvation come through the heralding of the message of Christ, but then all the rest of our growth and development in our knowledge of Christ and His Word is shaped by that weekly confrontation of souls with the preached Word. Sometimes we get people that say, "Well, the preaching is all there is. The program of the church doesn't matter. Just, you know, come there and hear the Word and go out home again." Now that's narrow and it's false. And it's totally insufficient. But I'll tell you, without that evangelistic thrust, that passion for the lost, that vision of what a church ought to be as a leaven and a lamp and a salt in the earth and a candle set as on a hill, heard shining through the epistles, which aren't theological treatises but the writings of a missionary on the run or in a prison cell, always evangelistic, always pulsating with a mission vision of what God intends for the world, unless that is heard, all the programs will probably just be so many cogs in the wheel of the machinery of the church. The tone that is set at 11 on Sunday